Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM is about doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Hey, what's up, New York City? It's Amy Wilson. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute live on WBAI. We are a socialist radio show and podcast from members of New York City's Democratic Socialists of America. The Democratic Socialists of America is the largest socialist organization in the United States with 95,000 members nationwide. New York City DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 9,000 plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. Once again, my name is Amy Wilson. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm a member of North Brooklyn DSA.
And my name is Bernard Goida. I'm a member of the Bronx and Manhattan, Upper Manhattan DSA, and I use he, him pronouns. I'm an activist and broadcaster.
Election day was yesterday when DSA's 30 plus nationally endorsed campaigns were put to voters. On tonight's show, we'll hear provisional election results and an interview with a DSA-endorsed candidate for Somerville, Massachusetts City Council, Tessa Bridge. Here in New York City, Eric Adams has, unfortunately, swept to victory as mayor. Adams has publicly distanced himself from the left and socialism, so to extend the courtesy, let me just say that ACAB includes him. How are we going to beat Adams and the bourgeois capitalist interests he represents? We'll be discussing this question live with our comrade Robert Cuffey. We will be taking your calls later in the show to discuss building socialism in New York and the surrounding area. But first, the headlines and a special elections update from Andrew Calloway.
The city government is expecting potentially thousands of essential city workers, especially police officers, firefighters, and sanitation workers, to go on unpaid leave beginning Monday, when the city's requirement that all city workers be vaccinated goes into effect. Former New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has been charged by the Albany County Sheriff's Office with forcible touching, a misdemeanor sex crime. Although some confusion emerged about whether the prosecutor's office and accuser had been notified beforehand. Cuomo is accused of groping a woman inside the executive mansion on December 7, 2020. The New York Rising Community Reconstruction Program, launched by then-Governor Cuomo in response to the destruction caused by storms like Sandy, was created to provide $750 million in federal funds to finance repair projects and install infrastructure to improve resiliency against future disasters. However, 9 years later, unnavigatable bureaucracies, opaque decision-making, and broken promises have resulted in communities unprepared for the next storm. The New York State Department of Environmental Conservation denied a controversial proposal for a new fracked gas power plant in Astoria, citing that the project was not in line with the state's Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act, which aims to reduce the state's greenhouse gas emissions by 85% by 2050. The decision also noted that the project would also not have complied with the Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act's provision that new permits shall not disproportionately burden disadvantaged communities. New York City is experiencing a surprising and remarkable return of native wildlife, which local ecologists and park officials attribute to a 40-year effort to expand and clean up our parks, rivers, and wetlands. Notable wildlife includes endangered sea turtles and a baby seal in Queens, seahorses at piers along the Hudson River, a coyote in Central Park, and bobcats in the Bronx. Parks officials say this resurgence needs to correlate with an increase in funding. A new report from the Pratt Center for Community Development found 30,000 basement units in the city that were previously unaccounted for, overwhelmingly in rent-burdened communities of color. Mayor Bill de Blasio announced a rollout of unannounced metal detectors and NYPD youth coordination officers to boost security at schools experiencing an uptick in violence since students have returned to in-person learning. officials have also pledged to hire 600 new social workers and counselors, and are rolling out a mental health screening for all kindergarten through 12th grade students this month. The Police Benevolent Association of New York sued in Staten Island over vaccine mandates. New York State Budget Director Robert Mujica accused CUNY officials of playing down their declining enrollment. And in election news, New York Attorney General Letitia James announced her plans to run for governor, making her a top threat to Governor Kathy Hochul. New York City Public Advocate Jumaane Williams also announced his run for New York governor. Five proposals are on the ballot November 2nd that give voters the power to directly change the state constitution. These measures include questions on the future of political representation in Albany, environmental protections, easier voter registration and absentee balloting, and how New York civil courts function. And now, an update on provisional results from yesterday's election. The Democratic Socialists of America national organization made over 30 endorsements in down-ballot races all over the country. While results are still being tallied and certified in many places, the following campaigns have claimed victory as of Wednesday morning. In Connecticut, supported by Central Connecticut DSA, Maryam Khan for Camden Board of Education and Abdul Osmanu and Justin Farmer for Hamden Legislative Council. In Florida, supported by Pinellas DSA, Richie Floyd for St. Petersburg City Council. In Massachusetts, supported by Boston DSA, Willie Burnley Jr., Charlotte Kelly, Ben Ewan Camden, and J.T. Scott for Somerville City Council, and Kendra Hicks for Boston City Council. In Minneapolis, supported by Twin Cities DSA, Jason Chavez for Minneapolis City Council. In North Carolina, supported by NC Triangle DSA, Danny Noel for Carrboro City Council. In Pennsylvania, supported by Pittsburgh DSA, Xander Orenson for Pennsylvania Magisterial District Court, and Anita Prezillo for Allegheny City Council. In Texas, supported by Austin DSA, the No Way on Prop A campaign to defeat a ballot measure proposing increased funding to the police. In Washington State, supported by Whatcom DSA, the People First Bellingham Initiative 3 to guarantee labor neutrality and protect the right to organize by prohibiting the use of city funds for union busting. And here in New York, supported by Rochester DSA, Kim Smith and Stanley Martin for Rochester City Council, and Robin Wilt for Brighton Town Board. Supported by Ithaca DSA, Jorge Defendini for Ithaca City Council. Supported by New York City DSA, Tiffany Caban and Alexa Aviles for New York City Council.
Thank you, Andrew. Our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by New York City DSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. You can subscribe at thethorn.nyc. DSA had so many races to track that we couldn't catch them all, but if you want to check out live results courtesy of Metro DC DSA, please visit washingtonsocialist.mdcdsa.org. Now let's turn to our live guest for tonight's show. Hi, Robert, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. I hope I get frequent appearance miles or some such thing.
Right. We'll give you the punch card after the end of the show. So you were on in June of 2020 in our Labor for Black Lives episode. For those who haven't heard that show or may not be familiar with you through New York City DSA, can you just briefly give our audience a reintroduction to who you are and what you do with the Democratic Socialists?
Yes, of course. So I'm Robert Cuffey. I work for the City of New York at the City's Administration for Children's Services, and I'm a proud member of Local 371 of DC 37, the Social Service Employees Union. And within the Democratic Socialists of America, I'm one of the at-large members of the organizing committee for the labor branch, and I work as well with the Afro-Socialists and Socialists of Color Caucus.
Thanks, Robert. It's been a tough day for left of center candidates nationally, hasn't it? With New Jersey Governor Philip Murphy appearing to secure victory only by the narrowest of margins. And in Buffalo, DSA's very own India Walton says that defeat looks likely against establishment-backed write-in candidate Byron Brown. So, Robert, what's your take on what's happened in Buffalo and what it means for socialism in New York State?
Well, I think, you know, India Walton's campaign posed enough of a threat to the establishment that they went to these desperate measures of a write-in campaign to stop what she was doing, which is to challenge the Democratic Party machine there. But I think in some ways, the close margin of victory and the fact that this write-in campaign was a success is in some ways due to India somewhat taking up progressive causes, but on the other end, not fully taking them on. If you look at the example of her wanting to defund the police and put money into other programs, but also saying that, you know, to a certain extent, we need the police, so they should be well paid. It's kind of like a question of are you fully on board or are there half measures? And I think to get people fully committed and to the polls, which is a problem in a lot of these elections, getting people to come out and vote, you need people to have a message you can be fully committed around.
Yeah, and what about the role of organized labor in some of these races up and down the country? There seems to be this strange disconnect between what's happening in electoral politics and what's happening with Striketober and the labor unions.
Yeah, well, I think with like all things, the labor unions have to be seen as the labor movement needs to be seen as two labor movements in many ways. It's the rank and file and the people who lead them. And even though most of the people who lead them are democratically elected, much like the politicians, they're elected by this very low turnout. So it's not clear that there's necessarily a mandate that they have. And even with the big picture that the labor movement in the United States has been in on the decline and contracting towards a point that only about 10% of the population is unionized now, the unions nonetheless retain a certain amount of power because they hold captive the collective resources of the working class in the form of our membership dues. But they also importantly hold captive like a list of working class people that they can mobilize to vote for this or that candidate. And the kind of unionism we've been seeing lately from the AFL-CIO and Change to Win and the other leading members of the union coalitions is one that's more focused precisely on their members and not a social justice type of unionism that would be more in sync with like an India Walton or a DSA type of campaign.
So in some ways, there's still the same machine politics on the union side as well.
Yeah, and you know, and part of it is that like ideally we would have liked many of these unions instead of endorsing Brown to endorse India Walton in Buffalo, right? But even if they had done that, we can still ask the question critically, what is the process for that endorsement? My union, for example, Local 371, endorsed Eric Adams, and no one asked me about it. And I don't know any coworkers who were asked about it either. So even if we do get these endorsements, we're looking for part of the question is, what are the democratic mechanisms within the union through which an endorsement is reached?
So what do you think the DSA and the progressive movement more generally should do now that appears to be a defeat in Buffalo, but we've had some successes more locally with people like Tiffany Caban getting elected to the New York City Council?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should definitely take time to celebrate the successes that we've had. The inroads we've made against the Democratic Party machine did not come by easily. It took a lot of people door knocking, canvassing, otherwise phone banking. But I think we also need a certain kind of recognition if we look at the other city council races like those of Michael Hollingsworth to say that we're not necessarily in a space where we can surprise the machine anymore the way AOC or Julia Salazar did. So it's really then a question of what layer of voters can we turn out that others cannot turn out? And more importantly, when we do get people elected, like realistically, what is the qualitative change we can see in working class people's lives through the resources we've poured into those candidates. I maybe don't necessarily have an exact answer, but I think it starts with examining, you know, where does real change come from? And in my experiences through the Black Lives Matter movement last year, it wasn't the fact that we had this or that politician elected that led us to get gains like the repeal of the 50A law that shielded the disciplinary record of police officers, but rather the movement we built in the streets. And I would say similarly for the labor movement, it would come down to the workplace organizing we do and how we tie that workplace organizing into wider social issues as part of social justice unionism.
Yeah, it's fantastic to hear so many success stories from across the movement, but clearly there's a long way to go, and that needs everyone to pitch in and help.
Yeah, I think just to put a little bit of texture on the story of Striketober, I think I completely agree with Robert's point that the rank and file may be growing in militancy to a level where it's going to outstep the leadership. And I do think that's one of the most interesting stories on the left today. You know, you look at something like the John Deere strike, where the members just voted down the contract for a second time and voted to continue a strike, which is a truly amazing feat of labor organizing, and really speaks to the fact that COVID, but also the conditions of capitalism in the United States in the 21st century, have accelerated the abuse of labor by capital to the point where many people are finding it intolerable. So I think people thought this was going to happen back in March and April of 2020, right when the COVID crisis was starting to hit. But I think it speaks to the fact that it does take organization and it does take time to fully mount a worker response. So Robert, do you have anything that you'd like to say in response to that?
Yeah, I think we can't ignore the larger structural issues, right? As socialists, we like to talk about our vision for the future and the current moment. But I think in meeting that moment, so to speak, we do have to talk about the fact that we do live in a capitalist system driven by profits. And overall, there's been a decline in the profitability of the system. So there's this, you know, larger long-term crisis of profits, but also this more acute cyclical economic crisis that we've been going through. And it's been expressed most acutely recently through the budget shortfalls we see brought about by COVID, right? So how do you then fill the budget shortfalls? The answer we see resoundingly everywhere from Democrats and Republicans alike is that you need austerity, that you have to make cuts. And it really just seems to be a bargaining over how deep the cuts go as to whether we can or cannot make cuts. And unfortunately, it seems like even the leftist politicians who get elected are forced to make that gamble as to how deep the cuts go. We can look, for example, at the recent last-minute decision by the slate of Democratic Socialists in the state legislature to turn around and vote yes on the budget when they steadfastly said all throughout the legislative session that they would not vote yes. And that had to do with them being strong-armed into voting yes for the budget to let funds for excluded immigrant workers pass. So it's a similar dynamic with union leaders, right, who may enter into periods of protracted struggle during contract negotiations, but then, you know, management says, well, here's the economic reality, you know, like there's only so much we can do. And they bring back these contracts to their workers, but the workers at this point are like facing their own lived experiences of things like medical shortfalls, food insecurity, and they say no. One of my first labor experiences was with the 2005 transit strike doing solidarity support for them. And it was quite an amazing thing to see that after that three-day strike, the transit workers who shut the city down rejected the first offer brought to them by union leadership and management. And unlike the John Deere workers, they did not have the confidence in organization to vote it down the second time. And since then, there's been somewhat of a decline in the labor movement because the transit workers are in many ways the strongest workers in the city because of their ability to shut the city down by not working. And there's just been this trickle down where now all of the unions, instead of pushing towards a kind of confrontation that we see in a strike, are more relying on negotiation. Like my union literally told us after Bloomberg was term limited that Bloomberg is not a guy we can work with. We have to wait for the next guy in office, who ended up being de Blasio. De Blasio threatened to lay off 20,000 of us last year. So then we were told Eric Adams is our guy. He's a union guy like us. But then Eric Adams went to the last debate and said he'll save money by cutting public sector jobs.
And I'd love to hear more of your thoughts, Robert, on Eric Adams and what organizing for socialism is going to look like under his mayoralty. But first, I'd love to remind our listeners that they are tuned in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. We are the officially endorsed show of New York City DSA, and we're here every Wednesday at 9 p.m. I'm Amy Wilson, here with Bernard Goiter and our live guest, Robert Cuffey of New York City DSA's Labor Branch and Afro-Socialist Caucus. And tonight, we are talking about the recent election results and organizing for socialism against the far right. And to that end, I'd love to take a moment to just speak to a recent experience that I had, as regular listeners of Revolutions Per Minute probably know. I'm a committed anti-fascist organizer here in New York City. And this past Thursday, I responded to a call by anti-racist organizers to defend a Black Lives Matter vigil on the Upper East Side, which happened to be right next to a rally called by FDNY, theoretically against the mandate of the COVID-19 vaccine. Now, you might be asking, why are mandates and vaccines an issue that anti-racists and anti-fascists are taking up? It's more complex than we have time to get into here on this show, but it does relate to a couple of the themes of tonight's discussion. One of which is that, you know, if you are ever unfortunate enough to be next to one of these rallies to see them pass by, you'll see flags flying that say Trump 2024. You'll see the Gadsden flag, Don't Tread on Me flag, which is a known symbol of far-right anti-government organizers. On Thursday, we also spotted the pine tree flag, which is a symbol of very scary Christian nationalism and Christian dominionism. And of course, you'll also see the thin blue line flag. So we have these rallies that are theoretically targeted toward city workers, but are dominated by cops and those who willingly affiliate with cops. So myself, as well as many of my comrades at this point, are thinking this isn't really about the COVID vaccine. This isn't really about the workplace issue of mandates. And this isn't really an example of organized labor or labor militancy in the same way that we're looking at with the example, say, of John Deere, UAW, or the Columbia grad students who are going out on strike today. Workers are dying of COVID, and workers have died of COVID at high rates, especially those who are from immigrant communities or Black and Brown, because they've been made to go to work under conditions that were unsafe for transmission of COVID. So many of us believe that is the proper application of COVID vaccines and COVID mandates. But beyond that, as anti-fascists, our major goal is to limit the organizing terrain of the far right. You've heard me say it on Revolutions Per Minute before. We cannot allow people to gather and rally in the streets of New York City under fascist and far right symbols to develop the connections that they develop there and to continue the organizing projects that they continue when they have that space. As socialists, we recognize that the far right is an imminent threat to the working class. And as anti-fascists, we're committed to being on the front lines of defending against that threat. So we see vaccines and mandates as essentially a wedge issue that is being exploited to advance a conservative politic. Vaccine hesitancy is a clear public health issue. I wish I knew the answer, but I don't. But I do know that I have no common cause with cops, and neither do does anybody in DSA? And that's what we're hopefully going to also be talking about throughout the rest of the show. And I thank you greatly for allowing me to share a little bit of that insight here on Revolutions Per Minute tonight.
Now we're going to turn to Somerville, where a slate of seven candidates have stood for election to be DSA councillors. One of them is Tessa Bridge, who I spoke to on Monday.
One of the things I would just say to folks who are listening to this is that it is really easy to feel despair, I think, in the moment that we're living through. And one of the greatest privileges of going through this process, just on a personal level, has been getting to know my community so deeply and the people who are here so deeply. And I am just amazed and inspired all the time by how amazing the people are in my own community and the people who are showing up. Like right now, we're in the middle of GOTV. On Saturday, it was pouring rain the entire day. We had people like biking up in their rain pants to take their lit and canvas. We had over 80 volunteers across the city out there canvassing for socialist candidates. And that, to me, gives me so much hope in the future. So I have two children, 4 and about to turn 6. And so this journey for me has very much been also part of my journey into parenthood. And, you know, I think it's a natural part of becoming a parent is thinking about, like, what do you want to leave for your children? And I think for me in particular, and I know this is true for other people, becoming a parent at such an uncertain time when, you know, the threat of climate change is, like, so imminent, when our country feels less stable than it's ever been, where cost of living and cost of childcare is so astronomical, it really brings in stark relief how much work is needed to be done. And I think that that's a huge motivator for me. It's just really thinking, just as you said, about like what kind of community do I want my kids to grow up in and what kind of example am I going to set for them? And I think, you know, it's the big and the small things, right? I want them to have a habitable planet to live in. I want them to have school buildings that are healthy to attend in, right? Like that's one of the things we've seen during COVID. I want them to live in a community that's climate resilient. So right now, one of the things we see in Somerville, I know New York has struggled with this too, is huge amounts of flooding because of climate change. And like, I want them to, you know, be able to live in a home and go to school and move through the streets in ways that are safe as climate changes. You know, we are a family that walks and bikes most of the time. I think a lot about street safety and the way that our streets are designed. And I want them to be able to ride their bikes to school and feel like they can move safely through our city. Housing is one of the biggest issues that I hear about on the doors. Cost of living, particularly cost of housing has skyrocketed here, and you know many, many people are struggling to stay in our community at all income levels because of how expensive it is. And so this is an urgent crisis that we're facing in Somerville, as in many places, and I think we need to use every single tool we have in our toolbox to address it. And so there are a couple levers that City Council has to pull that can really make a difference on these issues. So one is zoning. Here in Somerville, the council determines the zoning. So one of the things we can do is make sure that we're upzoning, particularly around the subway lines, the T-stops that are coming, and the subway is extending into Somerville right now. So there are incoming T-stops in my Ward 5. There are 2 stops that are about to open. So we need to make sure that we're building higher around that. And it's important to do it there because then we don't have the same parking requirements that we have in other parts of the city. And so when we build taller, we get more units. It's also important that as we're building, we are increasing the percentage of affordable units that developers are required to include in new development. So right now that's at 20%. I'd like to see that at least 25%, right? 25% of 50 units is more than 20% of 50 units, and 25% of 50 units is more than 25% of 30 units, right? So that's one of the ways that we can increase housing. It's really by holding developers accountable and not letting them wiggle out of that. And then I think it's important to acknowledge that we are not going to solve the housing crisis in the private market, just as you said. So part of the solution has to be building social housing. And I think we can do that at the municipal level. So we have funding that's coming from the state and federal government. We have commercial tax base. We have, you know, money coming back from the Green Line extension here in Somerville that we can put towards actually building municipal social housing that is mixed income, that is below market rate. We can make sure that, for example, municipal employees have access to that housing so that teachers, librarians, DPW workers can live in the communities where they work, which strengthens the fabric of our community. We can make sure that many of those units are accessible so folks with disability have safe places to live. We can make sure that many of those units are family size. That's a big challenge we have here. So much of the new development are small units. They're not big enough for families to live here. So we can really sort of control outside of the market what kind of housing we're adding into the system when we build them ourselves.
That was Tessa Bridge, who unfortunately lost her bid to be a Somerville councillor by 120 votes. But it was a successful night for some other progressive candidates in the region, with Michelle Wu, who favours rent control policies, taking the mayoralty. And as we heard, several other DSA-backed candidates have won races in New England, including seats in Hampton, Connecticut, and on Boston City Council. You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favourite broadcast app. Today, we're talking about elections, socialism, and anti-fascist organising. But let's also talk about victory and what victory looks like. We saw an amazing example of a successful campaign covered here on WBAI by the taxi workers of New York City, who went on hunger strike. A group of them went on hunger strike to fight for their rights to have unfair loans renegotiated by the city. And New York City has agreed with the largest bank that lent this money for a large chunk of these loans, that the city will step in and guarantee in the case of a default, allowing a huge haircut on these loans. And this is an example of where organizing and trade unions can really make a transformational difference to working class people right here in New York. And it's been an amazing campaign, and it's been fantastic to see candidates like Zoran Mandami, who's an assembly member and running for re-election. We saw him go on hunger strike. We've seen other huge amount of support for that campaign. And really, we need to tell these stories of this labor movement in action, this Striketober. And to do that, we need your help. So please call 212-209-2950 and give to WBAI. That's 212-209-2950, or just go to WBAI.org. Thanks.
Great. So let's finally turn now to the day's biggest electoral story here in New York City, which is what I find to be the unfortunate victory of Eric Adams, who will now be serving as New York City's mayor. Robert, talk to us a little bit about what led us to this place and why Eric Adams was able to win.
I mean, not to sound too doom and gloom, but every time they put the black guy in charge, it's because things are not going well. But, you know, on a more serious note, like the history of black mayors in the United States usually comes about when there is this kind of fissure in society where it's not clear how to move forward. And I think that's what the previous mayoralty represented under de Blasio, where he was hated both by the protest movement against police brutality and hated by the police, where he was loved by real estate developers, but also some of them felt that he was giving too many protections for tenants. So I think Eric Adams coming in needs to be evaluated in the context of us also losing Governor Cuomo to the very credible allegations of sexual assault against him, as well as having Joe Biden as president and having an incumbent Democratic president for whom the poor state of the economy can be blamed upon, right? So like Eric Adams comes in then as this moderate to say, well, look, you guys tried a left thing with de Blasio. You tried a left thing with this crazy defund the police movement. I'm the voice of reason. I'm a moderate. I'm a former union member. Please vote for me. And I don't really think, outside of maybe Diane Morales before her campaign imploded, that there were any other candidates in the field running for the Democratic Party nomination that had a message that could really counter that. Looking at voter turnout, where about 24% of people turned out to vote, I think it goes to show that it was not an Obama-type moment where, like, you know, people were very motivated by Adams or anyone else to come to the poll, but were really gritting their teeth to say, like, this is the best they can do amounts the lot offered to them.
Robert, what do you think the movement for Black Lives and indeed the movement to move funding from the NYPD and into social services? Do you think maybe that there might be a silver lining with the comptroller Brad Lander winning? Do you think maybe he's somebody that could be a potential ally for the movement?
I mean, I don't know. I trust politicians about as far as I can throw them, and I don't think I can throw Brad Lander very far.
He's quite big. Yeah, he's quite short, so you might be able to throw him, like, you know, a few feet maybe.
I don't think you've seen me, but I think more to the point, right? It then becomes a question of, like, what goes first, the cart or the horse? And I think there are politicians who can be pressured, of course. But you can't rely on them, I believe, to fulfill any kind of promises. And that pressure almost always comes from both working within the democratic mechanisms available to us within the system, you know, attending city council hearings, calling and lobbying, as well as the external pressure of the street protest movement and building up workplace actions. Amy would tell you that the latter is really my area of expertise.
Yeah, and let's speak to that a little bit, Robert. You know, one of the things that's been discussed both in the run-up to this election and now that we're sorting through the results, which of course are still coming in, many will have to be litigated in various places. But one thing we've heard a lot of is that, you know, defund is not a winning message for, quote-unquote, the left. Talk to me a little bit about that and how you would respond to that critique.
Yeah, I mean, I think at the height of the protest movement, over 50% of people supported the demand to defund the police. And I think it can get to those heights again in the middle of a movement. But without a mass movement, to me, it's a very simple way to explain part of the problem of capitalism, which is that, you know, the state, as we see it, the government, is the agency responsible for taking the collective resources of the people, most popularly in the form of taxes. And I think working class people should have a say in how it's spent and where it's spent. And if we look at the state of the country and the city's working class, we can clearly see declining rates of unionization, right? Declining wages. But if you look at the police specifically, it's different for them. They've actually become more unionized. Their wages have gone up. I've worked for the city of New York for over 13 years now. And if I was a police officer, for example, I'd be making so much more money just by being on the job for a few years. I would be able to retire in 20 years with a full pension benefits and just go on to have another job. And it's just a clear contrast of priorities, right? So it's like, to me, the question of defunding the police has to be brought into the context of where could that money go? If we defunded the NYPD by $3 billion, what could our community do with $3 billion? What could Brownsville, East New York, Southside Jamaica, Queens, and the South Bronx do with $3 billion? And I think any working class person can tell you the answer is that you can invest it into jobs, you can invest it into education, and in the context of COVID, you can most critically invest it into healthcare.
We've got around 20 minutes left of the show, so I'm going to take this moment to ask our listeners to join us. If you want to call in and get involved in the show, please call 212-209-2877. That's our call-in number, 212-209-2877.
And while we wait for calls, Robert, I'd love you to expand a little bit more on what you've put forward so far about, you know, the way forward. It's one thing to analyze how we got to where we are, but here on Revolutions Per Minute, we ultimately are about organizing. So can you tell me a little bit about what you're going to be working on in terms of your organizing in the coming months and years? And what do you see as most effective ways for us to be building power here in New York City right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think if there's one deficit that the current left and maybe the DSA specifically has, is the extent to which we have a base within New York City's working class, especially what's often referred to as the multiracial working class. So I think we need to find ways in which we can connect with everyday working class people. And I think one of the greatest places to start is in public housing. I personally am not a public housing organizer, but I've found people who live in public housing to be very approachable, easy to talk to. Some of the organizing I do is with a group called Black Voices Matter, which does a community cookout at a park in between the Tompkins and Marcy houses in Bed-Stuy. And community members there have been very receptive to the message of abolition and defunding the police we've been spreading. So I think for any political campaign or organizing to be successful, building a base amongst the people with the power to amongst the people with the power who both build society and who can shut it down in the blink of an eye is really important. And in New York City, both in the labor movement and without, that working class is a working class of people of color. It's disproportionately Black, made up of immigrants and women. And, you know, finding inroads to have those groups be reflected in our organizing spaces is a very important task.
Do you think that some of these, the return to the kind of street protests that we saw in June 2020 is a possibility? And do you think organizations like the DSA and the wider trade union movement can potentially channel that, some of that anger, and into a broader social movement that actually can stick?
Yeah, I mean, I think the protest movement, the return of it, is an inevitability. One of the first anti-police brutality protests I remember attending was around 2007, 2008 over the police murder of Sean Bell. And I sadly had to go to way too many more since then. And even though last year's over George Floyd and Breonna Taylor was the biggest, unfortunately there will be more, because I don't think there's a easy solution that stops the police from killing people. And the working class and oppressed people are self-organized in a way that they will organically respond, but also in a way that they leave lessons for the wider working class. I think if we looked at the Hunts Point strike earlier this year in the Bronx, you can see some of the tactics used in the street protest movement reproduced there, especially in response to the repression that those strikers face from the police, like jail support, for example, which is something we do for our comrades arrested by the police by showing up to the precincts where they're being held, was mobilized for the comrade, for the workers arrested on the picket line at Hunts Point. And those workers returned triumphantly to that picket line to continue to chant and use their slogans there as well.
It's incredibly politicizing and radicalizing, isn't it? Going through these protests and going onto the picket lines for workers and for young people especially.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is that, you know, because the union movement in the country is so small and contracted, and because working class people don't always identify themselves in the United States as working class, everyone likes to say middle class. For many people, the beginning of COVID, Striketober, the teacher strikes that happened over the last few years are their first experiences of strikes. And like, you'll meet people on the picket line who talk about it, who see the actual power of the working class in action and the ways in which those actions look back on things like the civil rights movement for inspiration, like the way the sanitation workers in New Orleans were picking up the slogan of the sanitation workers in Memphis, of I am a man, and these things. Like, it's really reverberating through histories and people's lived experiences, which they will hopefully take into their future organizing.
You are listening to Revolutions Per Minute. We are live in the studio, virtual studio on WBAI, and our phone lines are open. The number to call is 212-209-2877. Once again, that's 212-209-2877. Tonight's topic is the election results in New York City and nationally. We're here with a union city worker and a police abolitionist. So if you have any questions or constructive comments relating to those topics, we'd love to hear from you tonight. We've got a couple minutes left in the show. Once again, pick up the phone, dial 212-209-2877. That is 212-209-2877. To speak to us here on Revolutions Per Minute. And, you know, Bernard, I totally agree that picket lines are a radicalizing experience. And what's great about a picket line is it's one of it's a protest situation, or I shouldn't say protest. It's the labor movement doesn't like it when you call a picket line a protest. So I'm sorry to anybody who I just offended there. But it is a situation that's explicitly asking for community support in a lot of ways, as Robert alluded to as well. So in addition to things like jail support, what we saw during that Hunts Point strike were people like our comrade Desiree, who you might have heard here on Revolutions Per Minute, out there with jugs and jugs of hot coffee for people on the picket line who are standing around in the dark and cold, with breakfast, with other things that care for the physical needs of people who are out on the streets in whatever capacity they may be out on the street. So I think as well, the more that we build up our protest response capability in terms of things like mutual aid and community care, the stronger our overall movement is going to get. And I will just read that number for you one more time in case you're out there listening and you have ever been on strike, walked a picket line. Did you vote yesterday? Why or why not? We'd love to hear it here on Revolutions Per Minute. Give us a call, 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. And let's get one of these folks live on the air.
Hello.
Hi, you're live with Revolutions Per Minute.
Hello, I'm on the air.
You are.
Hi, I'm just listening to your program. I would like to know why the word socialism is so bad, according to most people. You know, like if you mention the word socialism, you know, the eternal socialist. Well, you know, we say we're a Christian nation. That's all Christianity is about, socialism, helping your brothers, helping your sisters, and doing for others. But in this country, socialism is a bad word.
Well, caller, rather than giving you my answer, I'd love to ask you a question in return. Why do you think that socialism is a bad word to some people?
I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. I'm just wondering, you know, because, you know, like it goes against everything that this country say is supposed to be about, helping people and doing good, socialists. That's what socialists is about. Brothers helping brothers. That's what I thought it was about anyway.
Well, you know, I agree with you that that's what socialism is about, but I don't necessarily agree with you that that's what this country is founded on. I think our country was founded on settler colonialism, native genocide, slavery, and these other ills, the original sins that we're still trying to get past. And my personal answer, and then I'd love to hear what Bernard and Robert think. I do think we have a couple of other callers on the line as well, is that socialism is a bad word because it's threatening to the current system, and the system will do anything that it can to defend itself against a threat. And we see that mobilizing. We see that with the example of Byron Brown versus India Walton up in Buffalo. The Democratic Party machine mobilized against the perceived threat of a woman of color who is espousing socialist and redistributive policies. So thanks for your call. And Bernard or Robert, do you have any response to that?
Yeah, I'd just like to say, I think the point about Christianity is, I mean, I think I'd love to know what Fox News would make of Jesus if he was brought on. They'd probably say he was a kind of crazy radical DSA member.
Yeah, I mean, I think as the most successful capitalist nation in the world, socialism in the United States is seen as such an evil word because it proposes to do a very simple thing, which is to organize our society based on people's needs instead of profits. And take a walk through Times Square. People's needs are not at the top of the advertising billboards. It's profits.
Right, but they should be. I want to get defund NYPD, refund NYC on a billboard in Times Square. Thanks so much for calling. Let's go to our next live caller.
Yes, hi.
Hi, you're live with Revolutions Per Minute.
Yeah, I want to go back to the idea that you're right. I don't have a lot in common with the police union, Pat Lynch, but politics make for strange bedfellows, as we say. And it so happens that for those of us who aren't interested in vaccinating, totally believe that people should have a choice. You know, you can vaccinate if you want, that's because it's a real pandemic out there, but to mandate it with so many things that are not answered, and all of this propaganda about if you're vaccinated, you don't have to wear a mask, you don't have to be tested, even though you definitely can be positive and you can spread the virus just as much as an unvaccinated person, is you know, telling of why, you know, we don't necessarily have to blindly listen to the same quote-unquote, you know, democratic machine that is against someone like a India woman. They didn't support her at all, and I'm a little curious about how she lost that race. You know, a write-in campaign, like, that's not an easy thing to do. So I want to challenge that. That's one thing. But this thing about us not, we have to be able to understand, hey, there are some times that we do agree with these other folks who, you know, when it comes to choice.
I must disagree with you, caller, although I thank you for listening to the show and calling in. And as I mentioned earlier, vaccine hesitancy and is a real public health issue, and I would never deny that. But I do think it's important to keep in mind that vaccination is something that has unlocked the human potential of many of the world's poorest people in the world today, and also historically. Just 100 years ago, children were dying of preventable diseases at very high rates here in the United States, and that is still the case in many of the world's poorest countries that are the most exploited by global capital. So I do think it's important to remember that vaccination has really enabled many steps forward and has changed the outcomes for people, people in the world, and people who are living in poverty. So I want to get that out on the air, and I want to also say there is no common cause for cops, and my argument is that it's not appropriate to march shoulder to shoulder to cops. And more than my opinion, I think folks will find it's not strategic, and their interests will not be served by forming alliances with the far right. We do have a couple of other callers on the line. We're coming to the end of our show, so let's go ahead and take the next call if we can.
Yeah, hello.
Hi there, you're live on WBAI.
Yeah, hi. Okay. First of all, I just want to say quickly, I am calling from West Harlem. I want to say quickly that the defund the police and the abolish the police does not go very well with a whole bunch of people who may otherwise support reforming police reform and accountability in a serious way. I live in a community in which there could be no community enforcement of anything. For example, people here throw garbage. They throw garbage wherever willy-nilly. They take their dogs to walk. They don't pick up after the dog. You try to tell some of these people anything, and you're risking getting into violence over a community effort that you probably might be trying to make. And while I support, I understand the slogan. I would not vote for somebody because they are pushing the idea of defunding the police, because I understand that it doesn't necessarily mean don't give the police any fund. We in America, and especially in this part of the country, is nowhere near to getting rid of a police force, right? We need police accountability, but we also need police in many communities to enforce the law, okay? And there are many people who would not vote for a candidate who is pushing seriously defunding the police or abolishing the police because they're afraid of that kind of, they don't want to get rid of the police. The police are needed, okay? Quickly about the vaccine.
I'm sorry, caller, I've got to cut you off just because of time, but I do want to give our guest, Robert, a chance to respond to what you just said before we end tonight's show.
Thank you, Amy. I would take a wild guess that the caller and I share a similar West Indian background. And I would say that, you know, I would not go back home to Guyana and raise the demand there to defund the police, because our police have no money, right? So it's a very specific demand to a very specific problem, which is an overbloated police budget, which has grown disproportionately since 9/11. And I hear the issues raised by the caller in his community, and I think they're very creative, effective non-police responses. Garbage in the street, people not picking up after their dogs is not something you need someone with a badge, a gun, and impunity to address, but you actually need a caring response, right? You need people within the community. And if our community sanitation services were funded to the tune of the NYPD, then we could actually hire community members to carry out that task. And those community members in turn would have jobs that sustain them and sustain their families. So those are just a very simple example of what it means to defund the police. It's defunding the police and refunding our communities.
Mm-hmm. And as Mariama Kaba would say, it also entails maybe not knowing all the answers right now and having the courage to envision and imagine a different type of society.
It's that radical imagination.
Mm-hmm. Hope is a discipline. Well, you have been listening to Revolutions Per Minute here on WBAI. We're coming to the end of our show, but you can always connect with us by emailing us at revolutionsnyc@gmail.com. You can find us on our website, revolutionsperminute.simplecast.com, or on Twitter at NYCRPM. I'm Amy Wilson here with Robert Cuffey and
Bernard Goida.
And we will see you in 2 weeks. And until then, remember to rebel against authority, kids. Bye-bye.